ever had a time where you were faced with a decision where the truth was required, but you knew that it wouldn't go well for you if the truth came out? For one reason or another, I'm going to share with you an experience that I had in my former days. I've told most of you in my testimony, I think, that I was not always the neat, clean, upstanding member of the community that I am today. That as a young man had many opportunities to display my youthfulness and foolishness. And at one point, me and some friends of mine, with nothing better to do, got tired of our video games, and somebody said, "Hey, you know what? I know that they happen to not lock the door on the local elementary school. How about we go," it was 2 o'clock in the morning at the time, "and let's go have some fun." And I said, "Hey, why not? Sounds like a blast, right? I mean, who wouldn't think that's a blast?" So we did. We went into the local elementary school. Sure enough, the back door was open. We walked in. We went around through the classrooms, drew pictures on chalkboards, drank some of the chocolate milk, and took a pocket full of pennies out of the lunch lady's cash carrier thing. And a couple of the guys that were with us grabbed a few other things like VCRs and computer parts and stuff. So, you know, it's things that the school board might have had issues with. And so we got out that night. And two of the friends got caught that night because apparently it looks suspicious for 15-year-olds to be walking down the middle of town at night with a VCR in their backpack. So the police picked them up and the process was begun. Well, for several months they never found out about the other two of us. Me and my friend, whose name shall remain anonymous. We'll just call him Friend. Well, a couple of months later, we were thinking we were clear, and we walked up the hill to his house, and as we came over the crest of the hill, sure enough, there's a squad car sitting in front of his house. And I said, "Jeremy," oh, I said his name. I said, "Ha ha, Friend." Apparently they caught up with us. Well, I was joking, but sure enough, they had. We got to his house. The police officer said, "Brian, you go sit in the living room. We're going to talk to Friend here for a little while." And so they sat there and they said, "Friend, we have it on some pretty good evidence that you were there that night and took part in those things." And he stone-facedly said, "No, sir, we were not there. I had no idea that my friend was such a good liar." And he said, "Absolutely not. We were not there. We spent the night here. We played video games. We watched movies all night." He says, "Ask Brian. He was there all night." And they said, "We are going to be talking to Brian, but we wanted to talk to you first." So they came out to me, and well, they told my friend, "Well, if we get one more person that says you were there, we are going to come and take you into custody under that evidence." And he said, "Okay, fine, but we weren't there." And so, of course, I'm sitting in the living room the whole time and heart pounding. And they said, "All right, Brian, let's go to your house." And I said, "Okay." So we go to my house. And obviously, my parents had known nothing of this situation because you don't tell your parents those kinds of things. It gets you into trouble. Well, I had to tell Mom. So she walks in the door, already having had a bad day. I still see the look on her face. And I said, "Mom, there's a couple of people waiting to see you. They want to talk to you." And it's the policeman. She says, "About what?" "Well, it's a long story. Let me tell you." So I fessed up to Mom. And we sat down with the police officer. And he says, "Now, Brian, you sat there and you listened to Friend say everything that happened. And I'm going to repeat the same thing to you that I did to him. If we find one more person that affirms you were there that night, we are going to come and take you into custody. Now, you be honest with me. Were you there?" And at that moment, I realized, hey, this is where the truth comes into play, right? And it's not going to look good for me if the truth comes out. Obviously, because I was guilty. I don't try to cover that at all anymore, but I knew that if the truth came out, it was going to go badly, both for me and for my friend. Really badly. And so I mustered all of the unrighteous courage that I could. And he says, "Were you there that night? Did you guys go into the school?" And I stiffened my upper lip and straightened my back and got the defiant sneer on my face and said, "Yes, we were there. We did the whole thing. We started here. We went into this room, and I fessed up to everything." I look back on that moment and say, I'm amazed at the workings of God in the human heart, because I know it was just a few months after this that I came to faith in Christ, that God was softening me even at that point to bring me to the position where I would put my faith in Christ. And I could not. Whether it was because I was a coward, there was not this great sense in me that I must tell the truth. I can be honest about that. It was terror, which is not a bad thing. Terror at your own guilt is not a bad thing. Have you ever been in the position where the truth was going to be condemning? Well, the truth in my case was going to be condemning because I was guilty. The truth that Jesus is facing, I should say that Jesus is facing, that Jesus is proclaiming in this passage, is a truth that is going to condemn him for a completely different reason. Just like the truth, was going to condemn me, I was condemned by the truth, Jesus is going to be condemned because he was innocent. I was guilty. He's not. And so we come to our passage in Matthew chapter 26, as Matthew is moving the narrative to the crucifixion. There is a necessary step that has to happen. He has been arrested. He's been betrayed. He's been taken into custody. Well, the next step that we all know in great crime dramas is the trial. There has to be a trial if you're going to condemn somebody. And what great crime drama doesn't come with a little bit of preconceived notion about the accused? Matthew 26, verse 57. It's where we pick up here. "Then those who had seized Jesus led him to Caiaphas the high priest, where the scribes and the elders had gathered." This little bit of introductory material that Matthew gives us sets the scene, because it mentions a name specifically, Caiaphas, who's the high priest. Now, if you look at the other gospel writers, you'll find another name mentioned that occasionally is referred to as the high priest, and that is Annas, A-N-N-A-S. Little bit of trickiness that goes on here, being 2,000 years removed from the historical events, but I can give you a little bit of modern perspective. When we talk about President Carter, what do we mean? We mean somebody who sat in the office some years ago, but because of the office, we still refer to him with that term. Is he the sitting president? No. Does he hold the office? No. But do we still refer to him as President Carter? Yes, we do. President Bush, President Clinton, President Obama. We still refer to them with the title because they at one time held the office, and therefore we give that respect to it. Annas, if you read in the Gospel of John, you'll read that they took Jesus to Annas first. Matthew doesn't mention Annas because Matthew is much more concerned with the official goings-on. Annas is not currently sitting as the high priest, but he is the father-in-law of the current high priest, Caiaphas. He's the father-in-law of Caiaphas. Now, Moses, in his law, set up the high priesthood, or I should say God gave them the high priesthood, and established it as a hereditary office. Aaron was the first high priest. It should pass to his oldest son, and so forth on down the line, which it did for many hundreds of years. Until right about the Roman times, if any of you have ever read the accounts in the book of Maccabees, not inspired books, but good history, the accounts of Maccabees. During that time, and especially later during the Roman occupation, starting in 63 BC, the Romans recognized the influence of the high priesthood and began to use it as leverage against the Jewish people. And so if there were a high priest that the Romans didn't like, they would depose him and put somebody else in the office to take his place. And so the high priesthood became not so much a hereditary institution as it did a political position granted for favors. Annas managed to hang on to the high priesthood for a number of years. And only when he was incapable of fulfilling the position was it transferred to his son-in-law. And so you can see the influence that he must have had being able to maintain the high priesthood despite the Roman occupation. Obviously, he was fairly pro-Roman, as is Caiaphas. And so when Matthew tells us that they were led to Caiaphas the high priest, John tells us they were led to Annas first. There's not a contradiction. Annas could be legitimately called the high priest because he held the office at one point. He's not the sitting high priest, but he probably would have been at Caiaphas' house during these proceedings. And so John grants him the honor of calling him the high priest there. Matthew, more concerned with the official legitimate business of the nation, only refers for us to Caiaphas, the current sitting high priest. And so that's what's going on. They're taking Jesus to Caiaphas' house, and he is the current sitting high priest. Jesus has been seized for the truth. He's being led to trial. And it is simply because they know who he claims to be, and they do not like it. Now, obviously, they don't believe him, or they wouldn't be arresting him for this. One of the motivations behind this arrest is because if Jesus, as a messianic figure, goes throughout the nation trying to raise up the population in a rebellion against Rome, the leadership is afraid that Rome will come in like a hammer and destroy the country, which they would. They do, in fact, in another 30 years, 40 years or so, when Titus comes in and completely destroys the Israelite nation, which ends in 70 AD with the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. This is what they're afraid of. And so they figure they can't have Jesus going about proclaiming himself to be the Messiah, because obviously he's not, so they think. So we have to stop him. And the way to stop him is we're going to arrest him. So they've arrested him. They're bringing him into custody. And it is purely because of his claims to be the Messiah. He has been seized for the truth. And they represent for us this first group of people that we'll see as we're going to look at different responses to the truth throughout this passage. They represent those who do not want the truth. They don't want the truth of Jesus' messiahship being proclaimed because they fear it will raise trouble for them. And how often do people avoid the truth because it will lead to conflict? Sometimes the most loving thing you can do is tell somebody, I shouldn't say sometimes, all the time, the most loving thing you can do is tell somebody the truth, even if it hurts. And we're bound to do that. Well, we have another example of responding to the truth, and that comes in the next verse, verse 58. Peter followed him at a distance as far as the courtyard of the high priest, and going inside, he sat with the guards to see the end. Now, Peter has recovered from his fear somewhat. Remember, he fled when Jesus was taken into custody, but he has regathered himself a little bit, at least enough to follow the mob of soldiers that have taken Jesus into custody, but he follows at a distance. He doesn't want to be mixed up in this whole ordeal, but he still wants to see how it's all going to turn out. John 18, one of the parallel passages to this, lets us know that the disciple John reached the high priest's house before Peter did. And so when Peter gets to the house, it's John that comes to the guards at the door and says, yeah, let him in. He's okay. And so John and Peter together there come into the palace of the high priest. Now, the courtyard that they're speaking of, our architecture is a little different. Sometimes we have a foyer in our house where we welcome guests, but Palestinian architecture at the time would have had a somewhat squarish-looking building, and in the middle would have been an open courtyard. This would be called a garden or the courtyard. You'd have maybe a fountain there or the well that the house would draw from, but it would have been open to the sky, and it would be a place where people from the servants or the master of the house and the people of the house, the family, could go to recline and relax. And all around would be surrounding, on the lower quarters would be the servants' quarters and places for animals, and on the upper quarters would be the dwelling place for the family. So the courtyard is inside the building, even though it's open to the outside. That's where Peter is going in to wait. A lot of people gathered there, guards, false witnesses, some of the disciples, at least two of them, and they are in there waiting to see what happened. It specifically tells us that Peter is wondering how this is all going to turn out. And we have to imagine being in Peter's position, because for the last 3 years, the confident one, the open mouth, insert foot disciple, has been blazing ahead, completely oblivious to what was actually going to happen. Peter was certain that Jesus is the Messiah. He's the one that tells us, "You're the Christ, the Son of the living God. You have the words of eternal life. To whom shall we go?" But he had set in his mind a certain outcome that he was expecting. He thought Jesus was going to raise up an army and defeat the Romans, just like the other disciples did. And he's had his ears closed to all of Jesus' messages about the cross. Maybe he interpreted them spiritually. Yeah, okay, Jesus, we get it. Self-sacrifice. We gotta sacrifice ourselves for you. That's right, because following you, you're gonna take us into battle, and we might die in that glorious battle, but so be it. But being arrested? Actually being crucified? That wasn't part of Peter's plan. And for the first time, we see Peter acting with no confidence about what's gonna happen. Because here he is, just passively waiting to see how things are going to turn out. At what point in the last 3 years have we ever seen Peter just sitting by waiting to see what will happen? God has brought him almost to the point he needs to be a useful disciple. It's going to take one more event that we're going to look at next week. Right before the rooster crows, Peter's going to come to his lowest point. But Peter is following at a distance because he's afraid of what that truth is going to mean for him. And at this point, I don't know that Peter is so much afraid of being arrested, although that's probably part of it, but he's afraid of what's going to happen. He's placed all of his hopes in this Jesus, the Messiah. How can he be crucified? What is that going to mean for us? And so Peter's afraid of the truth. And how many of us, folks, if you're really honest, how many of us have remained silent at times when we should have spoken up? Times when we should have said something? Whether it's sharing the gospel with somebody, or applying truth to a certain situation, maybe even rebuking a friend. My guess would be, because I know myself, that we all have that. We all have those moments where we feel like, I should have said something. So we can sympathize with Peter pretty well. Not Peter, but 59. Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking false testimony against Jesus so that they might put him to death. But they found none, though many false witnesses came forward. And at last, two came forward and said, "This man said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days.'" And the high priest said, lost my spot. And the high priest stood up and said, "Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you?" But Jesus remained silent. These men are going to become a great example for us of those who try to silence the truth. They try to completely shut it up. They try to completely stifle it and keep it from being able to shine its light. The chief priests, they are blatantly said to be completely biased in the outcome of this trial. So what's one of our great freedoms that we preserve here in America? A man is presumed until proven guilty. Not the other way around. Get a kick out of watching the old Western shows on MeTV. Anybody else into Westerns? They're a lot of fun. I like watching them. They got a lot of great examples of character building and things in them as heroes stand up for what's right. But I notice a common theme is that very often the hero has to stand against an entire town that wants to just execute a guy because they think he did something wrong. And so the ranger or the sheriff, whatever, has to stand between a mob of people and an unconvicted person. And at one point, one of the heroes even said, it'd be better to let 1,000 guilty men go free than to convict a single innocent person. And of course the town says, that's nonsense! We'd have chaos! We gotta execute this guy! Well, this is what's going on. The Sanhedrin and the chief priests have already got their mind made up. They want him dead. They know, though, that he hasn't violated any laws. So they have no actual charges to bring against him. So what's the obvious answer? We're going to make up some charges. We gotta find some way to stop this guy. So since we can't find a way to legitimately accuse him, we are going to falsely accuse him. And it's specifically stated that they are looking for false witnesses. Now, they have a little bit of trouble, which it introduces a fun irony into the story. That they are willing to look for, purposely, false witnesses, but they are not willing to violate the trial itself. See, they still want to have a mock trial to give it some semblance of legitimacy. After all, they're going to have to hand him over to Pilate with an explanation of what he did wrong. They can't just hand him over to Pilate and say, we don't like this guy, let's kill him. Because Pilate would say, yeah, get out of here. Not going to handle that. Remember, at this point in history, the Jewish leaders do not carry the power of the sword. Rome will not allow Israel to execute prisoners. So if they want him dead, they have to convince Pilate that he's worthy of death. That's the purpose of the trial, so that we can hand Pilate the minutes from the trial. You know, they have that little stenographer there with a tiny little typewriter just punching away, keeping minutes. And they did keep minutes, by the way. Writing down everything that was said, but they have a problem. They're looking for false witnesses, but notice what it says here, that even though many false witnesses came, how many could they find? None. Very literally worded, it says, not one was found. Well, how can you not find false witnesses, though many false witnesses are coming? Here's the issue. According to Moses' law, how many witnesses does it take to condemn a man to execution? At least two. And it's not just two people that come along and say, yeah, he's guilty. They are supposed to thoroughly examine the two witnesses. Ever hear of cross-examination? So, all right, if you're on MeTV, you're probably also watching, oh, what's that guy's name? Perry Mason, all right? And he's a lawyer. He's designed to protect the innocent and get the guilty convicted. And his job is to cross-examine the witnesses. So it's not just the guy that's prosecuting that asks the witnesses questions. It's also the defense attorney. This system, our legal system, is very strongly built upon the principles in the Old Testament law. Witnesses must be examined. Their testimonies have to agree in order to be binding. So the problem that they're having is not that they can't find a single false witness. They've got many. The problem is they can't find two that agree with each other. So the statement that's being made is not one agrees with another. Even though many false witnesses are coming, they're finding problems in their testimony. Isn't that an interesting point, given that Jesus never did anything wrong? Now, they have no concept here that Jesus is sinless. We understand that from everything else that Matthew has told us, like the baptism, this is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased, the temptation, everything else that's followed. This concept of the sinlessness of the Messiah, absolutely necessary for salvation. They're not even looking at that. All they want to know is, can we find something to convict him of? And they can't. And so, they're trying to kill him. They can't find any false witnesses, even though many people are coming forward claiming to have witnessed Jesus do something that is worthy of death, but their testimonies do not agree. And so, at last, end of verse 60, at last, two came forward and said, this man said, I'm able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days. Gasp. I mean, don't you think that's worthy of death? This is the testimony they get. And here again is part of the irony of this, that finally when they do get two people to agree on testimony, Jesus actually said this. John chapter 2. He's in Jerusalem at a feast. And he's looking, they're looking around at the buildings. They're demanding a sign from him to prove that he's the Messiah. And he says, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. They assume he's talking about the temple standing behind him. John lets us know he's clearly talking about his body, and he's referencing the resurrection. Several times throughout Jesus' ministry, he has used the resurrection as the definitive miracle that proves who he is. That's why Paul says in Romans chapter 1, he was raised again for our justification. The resurrection proves that everything he said was true, and it proves that his sacrifice was sufficient. It proves that our salvation is secured. It is the definitive sign of who Jesus is and what he did. So, there must have been at least two guys that heard Jesus spoke in John chapter 2, so they come to the Sanhedrin, and finally we have two witnesses that agree they can nail him down on this statement. Destroy this temple and I'll rebuild it again in 3 days. There's only one trouble. He didn't do anything illegal. And the high priest knows this. He's got two witnesses, so he's got that next part of his plan in place, but they really don't say anything condemning of Jesus. I mean, maybe if you take things, he's trying to destroy the temple, that's like a terrorist threat, maybe we can get him on that, but they don't have anything to go on. And so, rising up, the chief priest says to him, have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you? Now notice what he's trying to do here. They don't have any evidence against Jesus, so what's the high priest looking for? Incriminate yourself. Give us something to go on. Don't you say anything? I mean, most of the time when people are being accused of things, they try to defend themselves. But Jesus recognizes something that we have actually enshrined in our Constitution. Fifth Amendment rights. You do not have to incriminate yourself in court. Jesus remains silent. Of course, he's not exercising his Fifth Amendment rights because the Fifth Amendment didn't exist then. But he's remaining silent for a purpose so that he can drive home this point. You have nothing to convict me of. And if you're going to convict me, I'm going to have to give it to you. You remember what Jesus said? Who takes his life from him? Nobody. I lay it down of myself, and I'm able to take it back up again. Jesus went to the cross willingly. He wasn't forced there. It was all part of the predetermined plan of God to save us. And so the priest is trying to move this trial forward and gain some edge against Jesus, but he recognizes he's got nothing. And so he challenges Jesus to make some answer, hoping that answer will be enough evidence to convict him. But what does Jesus do? Jesus remained silent. You have nothing. So here are these men who are trying to silence the truth. Many people try to silence the truth. They try to stop us from talking by calling us names, by trying to get us to bow into fear. You're hateful. You're bigoted. That's intolerant. How can you believe that Jesus is the only way? That's not very nice to people that don't believe in Jesus. They try to silence the truth, one way or the other. And many respond to the truth of Christ by trying to silence it because their soul is so enraged against God and his truth that they can't even stand to hear it. I mean, think about when Stephen preaches his sermon. What's the response of the people? They gnash their teeth. Because they cannot stand to hear the truth being proclaimed. Well, Jesus doesn't end there. He's not going to allow the truth to be silenced because the crucifixion must continue. It must happen. It is part of the plan of God. And so he's going to give them what they are looking for in verse 63. The high priest said to him, I adjure you by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. So he is frustrated at this point that he's got nothing to go on, no way to actually condemn Christ for anything that he said, and so he tries to bring it to tries to force things to move about by calling this oath upon Christ. I adjure you by the living God. Now think of the irony here. Who is the chief priest speaking to? The living God. I adjure you by yourself. You realize that's the only time God ever swears an oath is when he swears by himself. I swear, by myself have I sworn that in blessing I will bless you, he says to Abraham. Yeah. Well, he doesn't recognize who Jesus is, but that oath is ironic. Give us something. So he point blank asks Jesus if he's the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now notice that he combined two things there that most people in the first century would not have combined. Messiahship and the Son of God. Messiahship, in most people's minds, was simply an office to be filled about reclaiming Israelite superiority in the region. They didn't recognize the full mission of the Messiah. But in order to convict Jesus, the high priest conflates these two ideas. Are you the Messiah, the Christ, the Son of the living God? Because if you say yes, you're going to be condemned for claiming to be the Son of God. If you say no, your followers are going to abandon you because you just denied being the Messiah. It's kind of like the old question that they try to tease people with and say, Gary, do you still beat your wife? You know, how do you answer that? Because if you say yes, you're guilty of wife battery. If you say no, the question was phrased in such a way that you don't still do it, but you used to. Well, this is how he's trying to trip things up. Of course, Jesus is not going to be caught in that, but there's what's happening. So if Jesus says yes and claims to be the Messiah, he's also claiming to be the Son of God, which in most of the people's minds will be blasphemous. And if any other man had claimed it, it would be blasphemous. Unless it's true. Has Jesus given sufficient evidence to prove that he is the Son of God? Now remember, in the biblical conception, sonship is not about descent. We talk about my son because he descended from me. But in the biblical sense, sonship has another aspect to it that's not just about descent, but is about sharing the essence and qualities of your father. Why did God create a world in which everything reproduces after its own kind? Tomatoes beget tomatoes. Pumpkins beget pumpkins. Humans beget humans. And even more so than that, the humans that come from me look and act an awful lot like me because they share my essential characteristics, right? Jesus being the Son of God is not about him being produced by God, which is the error of some teachings like the Jehovah's Witness and the Mormon Church. God didn't create Jesus. That's not the sense of sonship we're talking about. He is the Son of God because he shares all of the essence and character qualities of the Father, though he's not equated with the Father. You say it this way, he's not equated with the person of the Father, but he is equal with the person of the Father. Equal in all glories, equal in all attributes, equal in all perfections. And so if he says he's claiming to be the Son of God, he's going to be condemning himself in the eyes of the people that are present because they don't think it's true. Now, if it happens to be true, which it is, then it's the height of blasphemy not to recognize it. And so Jesus answers with this simple phrase, "You said it. You said so. This came out of your mouth." So if you're going to condemn me, it's still going to be unjust because you're the one saying this. And just because Jesus never outright said, "I am the Christ, the Son of the living God." You know, those words never exited his mouth, but he left us plenty of evidence in the other things he said. Before Abraham was, "I am." In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Jesus clearly about his entire ministry, who he is, the Christ, the Son of the living God. So he doesn't deny it, but he doesn't outright claim it, so that this trial can be shown to be a mockery. But he proclaims the truth. And here's where he's going to give them what they need to go on. "I tell you, from now on you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." This is a very clear reference to Daniel chapter 7, where the one like the Son of Man is riding on the clouds of heaven, conquers the Antichrist's kingdom, and sets up an eternal kingdom. It's very clearly referencing the Messiah and the Son of God. So Jesus says, "That's me. Read Daniel 7. I'm the one on the clouds." I'm the one seated at the right hand of power. Very literally there it says the power. Who's the power? God is. The Father is. I'm seated at the Father's right hand. Why is that? Because I'm His Son. But once again, not in the sense of that He created me or that I am begotten or not that I'm proceeding from Him, but in the sense of I share all of the essence and qualities of the Father. And so Jesus proclaims the truth and gives them exactly what they were looking for by telling them the truth. Who is He? He is the Messiah. He is the Son of God. Now, the only reason they continue on to condemn Him here is because they don't believe it. But He is proclaiming the truth. Well, how do they respond to the truth? Then the high priest tore his robes and says, He has uttered blasphemy. What further witnesses do we need? You have now heard His blasphemy. What is your judgment? The high priest tears his garments in this symbolic expression of extreme duress. I am so flabbergasted by what he just said that I'm going to rip my garment asunder. And so they would literally grab their robe and tear it to show how upset they were. And what's he upset at? He claims that Jesus is uttering blasphemy. Now, if Jesus were not who he says he is, then this would be the height of blasphemy. But as we said earlier, if he is who he says he is, and you don't recognize it, that's the height of blasphemy. And so the high priests have really trapped themselves here. He has uttered blasphemy. What do you think? The leaders are clearly outraged and offended by this truth, and so they all utter the same thing. He's guilty of death. They obviously think that they themselves are the judges of what is true, rather than submitting their opinions to what God has said. And they're offended by the truth. You're going to run into a lot of people, too, that'll act this way. They try to establish themselves as the judge of God's character, to try and malign God, to try and say He must not be just or He's not loving because of something Scripture tells us. Don't ever mistake this, that we as created beings will never be quite comfortable with who God is. He's too great. There's always some aspect of His character that eludes us. Right now, in our current setting in society, I think that issue is mostly the exclusiveness of Christ. Can somebody be saved apart from putting their faith in Jesus Christ? The biblical answer is no, they can't. But the world hates that statement. Oh, what kind of a loving God would do that? Well, you know what? We're not the judges of how loving God is. He tells us He's loving. He expresses it through Jesus Christ. It's our responsibility to believe it. And even if it doesn't look loving, that's where we submit ourselves to Him and say, well, you know what? I don't understand everything about you. I never will. But you said this, and I believe it. Well, many people will act offended at the truth, just like these high priests did. And often they will take it to this next level and they'll begin mocking the truth. So they hand him over to the guards that are there. And once again, these are probably Jewish guards, not Roman guards. He'll be handed over to the Romans later. Verse 67, they spit in his face and they struck him and some slapped him, saying, prophesy to us, Christ, who is it that struck you? Spitting in the face is an extreme form of insult. Anybody ever been spat upon? I mean, not by your brother or sister, but truly in an insult, somebody spit on you. Well, I have. It's gross. It's nasty. It is that person communicating to you that you are beneath contempt. I'll spit on the ground, and I'll spit in your face, so it's like I'm saying, you're lower than dirt to me. They are treating him that way because they're mocking who he says he is. They're mocking the truth. And then blindfolding him, they'd slap him across the face and demand that he tell him who they are or who it is that did it. Imagine this, though. This is the Creator. This is the man that shaped those hands while they were growing in their mother's womb. This is the Creator who knows how many hairs are on each of their heads, and they are mocking him for it. Why did he endure all this? Why wouldn't he come down with his legions of angels and rescue himself from the situation? Because of what we read in Acts. because God the Father has made him both Lord and Christ. He delivered him up for our sin. And he will raise him again for our justification. Isn't he great? We're going to close our time together by singing, Lord, you are more precious than silver. Because the Creator God, who endured all of these things, did so out of his love for you, that you might be saved, that you might be redeemed, that you might be eternally protected, and that you might worship him for how great he is. So let's join together as Dan comes and leads us. Lord, you are more precious than silver.